Old age is very distressing, and then death. I mean, those who have lost friends and relatives to suicide or to disease or to accidents or to old age, it is very, very traumatizing. And the addition of the trauma is that it's going to happen to me. And we like to put this aside as much as possible. And that's why in the Mahabharata, the great epic that this Bhagavad Gita has been extracted from, Yudhishthira, the older brother of Arjuna, one of the main characters, is talking to Yamaraj, who is the superintendent of death. He's the judger. And Yamaraj asks him, what is the most wonderful thing? This is a very famous section of the Mahabharata. And Yudhishthira replies, we're here and we're seeing so many living entities going into the abode of death, yet we plan out our life like we will live forever. Like we will not see death. This is the most wonderful thing. That we're completely... we're either completely fearful of it or we're just completely ignoring the fact. Of course, when you get to a point that this verse is talking about, a point of certain knowledge, then this distressful fact is no longer a distressful fact. Birth is not distressful, old age is not distressful, and death is not distressful because you have a higher vision of things. And this is essentially what we need. Otherwise, happiness will come, happiness will go. Misery will come, misery will go. And we will go on and on. And of course, misery will intensify as the body gets older and the mind becomes more attuned to realizing the misery. It was, Schopenhauer. I did an essay on Schopenhauer for our degree. And he was saying the brute, the unintelligent man or the animal, he does not enjoy very much, nor does he suffer very much, because his intelligence is not refined. It takes an intelligent being to enjoy, and it takes an intelligent being to suffer. So the advantage of this life is, I'll just finish, the advantage of this life is that as you get older, you become more intelligent, and you can suffer even more. Yeah, he's suffering like a dog, but the thing is, the unintelligence to handle the suffering of a dog. If you suffer like a dog, the dog is in a pitiful state. You know, if you suffer like a dog with an intelligence, then it's really hard. Yeah, but yeah, I mean, it's true. The more you, when people attain knowledge and are still in the mode of ignorance, they're still not intelligent enough to process it, it's actually distressful. And that's why in the third chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, which I just also did an essay on, the third chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, it talks about not disturbing the ignorant. If someone is not ready to take up certain things, you should not push too much. That's why Bible bashing and Bhagavad Gita bashing is not approved of. We don't tell people to do things. We instruct them in things that they can do. It must be doable. Like, a lot of people have a difficulty with animal rights movements because they kind of hit on everyone to do things. But they're a little bit more, I mean, they're very intelligent, and this is the point. The point is they give recipes. Why do people give recipes? Because it's easy to tell you that, you know, hurting creatures is bad and this and that, but without giving someone an alternative to what they do, they're not going to do anything. They're just going to feel really distressed and bad about it. So you don't go tell everyone you're suffering birth and death and you're going to die and it's horrible and this and that, unless you give them something. Because all they're going to do is make sad people. Our job is not to make the sad world sadder. This is not our philosophy. We're supposed to be giving people happiness. So you have to be intelligent when you propagate any sort of spirituality, any sort of religion, any sort of philosophy, that it's applicable. Unapplicable philosophy is just, it's just, you know, mumblings of the mind. It has no sense in the world. It doesn't help people. So we can rant and rave about all sorts of wonderful idealisms, but we have to be able to give this to people. And that's why Krishna consciousness is a process. It's something you can do. we give people something to do. And with our temples, we try as much as possible to have that as our aim, that we have something for people to do. Okay, material world is very distressful, you know. Suffering is going on, no problem. We have something for you to do that is less distressful. Come here and do some service for God, and hear some philosophy, and just take some peace. This is what we're supposed to be doing. We're not telling everyone, you know, you are an ignorant fool, and you are a demon, and you are a monster. How dare you, you sinful wretch, you. This isn't helpful. Just turning people away from God. You're doing a disservice to people. Anyone who wants God or spirituality, any sort of yogic advancement, you're turning them away. So you're doing disservice. So what is this amritam? What is this immortality? This is that of the spiritual world. And in our philosophy, as of many philosophies in the West and the East, ours is a monotheistic, God-conscious philosophy. You can find monistic, non-God philosophies in India and outside, and they have a lot of... The advantage of India, it seems like they all agree on a lot of premises, so you can still kind of, like, be cool with everyone. Non-God, I just kind of made... Well, monistic as in, like, well, there's no personal God. It's just you are the supreme, and we are the supreme. So this is also the philosophy of many people in India and many people outside India, many concoctions of the mind. But there is very sophisticated levels of philosophy in India and in the scriptures there, and all the ancient books of wisdom. And some will attribute spirituality without a form, without a personality. But we prefer to call ourselves personalists. We believe God is a person, and that is not so hip these days. It's not so cool. Not everyone's into calling God a person, because it's been kind of misused throughout the centuries pretty badly. A lot of people were burned on stakes, and we lost a lot of natural medicine due to certain religious adventures. So, he's not so popular in one sense these days, but that's part of this world. This world is, do we want to love God or not? And what do we want in our life? And in our philosophy, God gives you whatever facility you need. Atheist, agnostic, theist, no problem. Whatever you need, there you go. Of course, you know, when you become a devotee of God, then he kind of takes special care, and we see that. Sometimes special care looks like Arjuna's special care in the Mahabharata, where he gives him all sorts of calamities and he has to work them out. So it's not always just like smooth roads in the world of God, but mostly, you know, in the more essential way he takes care. Naturally, anyone who's suffering will not agree that God gives them what they need. But of course, our theology includes it includes karma from previous births, and this is not the thing you say to these people. This is not a very compassionate thing, and we are compassionate people. We often need suffering. That's what I was just saying. Arjuna, he was God's best friend. They were friends. They were buddies in the epic of the Mahabharata, and that's why in the second chapter, he has to go from the relationship of buddy to, okay, you are my guru, you are my teacher. But actually, Arjuna and his family were suffering for many years. Very harsh suffering. They were kings that were thrown into the forest. And many attempts at their assassination by poisoning, by fighting, by burning their house down. So many things. So... our theology has a different view on suffering. Suffering is part of this world. As long as you engage in this world, you will do good things and you'll do bad things, and you will create good circumstances and bad circumstances. And in the focal point of one lifetime, when you see a massive amount of suffering on a living entity, it will look very, very horrible. You know, to see the torture of anyone is very horrible. But in the massive outer scope of an eternity of ups and downs, it's very sensible. But in saying that, our goal is to stop suffering for everyone. And that doesn't mean food relief. It can mean. It's okay. It's pious. But we have a nice little play we sometimes do where there is a man drowning and someone goes to rescue the man from drowning and he brings back his coat. And someone says, "Why did you do that?" He says, I saved the coat. And the point is that the body is, as we know, we are embodied, we are souls in the body. So to save the body is not the ultimate purpose of our life, it's to save the soul. Of course, doesn't mean you just, often a lot of people then go and be very negligent of everyone and their physical and mental needs. Doesn't mean that you become emotionless. That's impersonalism. So we're trying to propagate knowledge of the spiritual reality. For us is a personal reality, because this is an eternal reality, and it's eternal means that it's what we as a soul, as ourselves, are programmed to do. It's our place. We use the word dharma. Dharma is essential. It's the essence of, you know, the dharma of fire is heat and light. You know, when you think of fire, you think of heat and light. So the dharma of the soul, the sanatana dharma, eternal, sanatana eternal, the eternal essential purpose of the soul is this relationship with God and within his kingdom. I don't like to use the word kingdom because in our theology we're not so into opulence. but it's essentially relationship with all those around us and a God figure. This is what we have. And it's loving relationships. So we have love as our eternal principle and not the Hollywood love. So it is saying that when the embodied being is able to transcend these three modes associated with the material body, he can become free from the birth and death. So in the purport, Prabhupada is explaining that he can enjoy the happiness of spiritual life even in this body because, he says, after leaving this body, he is certainly going to the spiritual sky. So what he's saying here, and then I'll get to the next point, is he's saying with the anticipation that you know that you have a pretty good chance of going to an eternally wonderful place, you get pretty happy about it. You become joyful. Naturally, you know, if you know you're getting a new job and it's going to be good, or you know you're going to get this or that, and you know it's going to last a long time, you get excited. You're happy beforehand. You know, I'm going back to Australia soon, and I'll miss Radadesh, but I'm really happy that I'm going to get to go to the beach. You know, I'm already happy about it. I'm not even at the beach. I'm happy about it. So that is there. And then he says, and just a point too: those who are in the mode of goodness, although we know it's material, this verse is saying that it's material. But they're happy because they know that their karma will be good. They know that I'm doing good things and good things will come. So then they're actually happy. They're not afraid of death because of that. But even more so, we're not afraid of death because it's not good karma that's coming, but it's something above karma. It's actually the eternal role that we want to play in the reality. It's something that we always want to do. So it's there, and it's on the brink, it's on the horizon. But even in this body, he can enjoy spiritual happiness. So it's not just in anticipation, it's that the spiritual reality is actually what we are connected to. So even in this body, we can experience that, because that is always what we are supposed to experience. And we've covered ourselves with so many ideas of this world, this world and this body, but actually eternally and even now we are somewhat connected to the spiritual realm. So even within this body we can be at the liberated state, and that's why when you hear they were liberated in this self-same body, people get confused about what that means. They think that this material body then became liberated, but what it means is that the liberation came before we die, actually. So it means that you experience spiritual bliss and the spiritual reality before you die. it's not necessary that you need to die, because that would mean that spirituality is dependent on external circumstances, and this is exactly what we're saying it's not. So, you know, we often say Krishna burns up all our karma, which is true, but it's not that he even needs to burn up the karma, because we can just be connected regardless. You can have an abundance of horrible, blissful karma waiting for you, you know, being crushed to death or being made a king, but if you attain spiritual realization, your body may live on, but your being will be submerged in spiritual reality. This is essentially what it's saying. And we have three principles attached to this eternal reality. We attach them to God, and we attach them to each soul. Sat, Chit, Ananda. Sat we use is the eternal principle of existence. We exist. You exist, people. Don't worry. That is always there. Chit is knowledge. It means also like we're cognitive, like we think. Because you can have an eternal blob of nothing. It's possible. And you can experience being an eternal blob of nothing for a non-eternal period of time. That's called Brahman realization, which is what we were talking about, the non-personal monistic philosophers aim for. But then we have cognition, which you can also experience without the next factor for a certain period of time, which is Paramatma realization, it's called. It's talked about in the purports and it's talked about in the Bhagavatam, where you have, yeah, you're aware and you have spiritual awareness, not just material awareness. And then you have Ananda, a bliss. And this bliss is not just... bliss means happiness. It's not just, you know, a state of perpetual one-motioned happiness that people try to attribute to the impersonal realization. It's the bliss of relationship. It's Bhagavan. That's the realization of Bhagavan. And Bhagavan means the realization of God as a person. Brahman is in the Bhagavatam, and it talks about it, and it talks about Brahman, and Brahman in our theology, it means you get to the point of realization where you understand there is an eternal principle, an eternal supreme principle that is God. But it doesn't mean that God is a person, it doesn't mean that God thinks, it's just it's an eternal power. And then Paramatma realization, he's the ultimate self. You realize that there is a supreme substance that is cognitive, that has thought process, that does things. But Bhagavan, it means, you know, the great person. You experience God is not just an eternal principle of energy. He's not just a cognitive, a supreme cognitive being, but he is actually capable of interacting with you. And this is our ultimate realization. So these principles apply to God and they apply to the souls. We are essentially eternally powerful, eternally cognitive, and eternally capable of relating to one another and having blissful, happy relationships. We get our pleasure from interacting with others. This is the essential platform. There are many philosophies that don't agree with this because, as we experience, there may be pleasure from relationships, but there's also pain. And so such philosophies, like many Buddhistic philosophies, they want to negate the world and they want to be removed from the world. But we say that this material world is a perverted reflection of the spiritual world, and these three principles are reversed. So rather than being eternal, existing, we die. And we're born and we die. We're not eternal. And rather than having knowledge and cognition, we become dull and stupid and ignorant. And we, you know, drink away our sorrows. And rather than having loving relationships, we have fights and, you know, abusive relationships, and we don't get along. So this is a lot of people then say, well, these are all there, or I want nothing to do with the universe. We say, no, you don't want nothing to do with the universe. You want nothing to do with the material universe, which can also mean you want something to do with the spiritual universe. So that is what we're propagating. And attaining such a state and contemplating such a state relieves the distresses of birth, death, and old age. Are there any questions or comments at this point? Madhu was first. He jumped up. Sorry. In other words, devotional service in Krishna consciousness is the sign of liberation from material entanglement, and this will be explained in the 18th chapter. As far as I know, he's saying that Krishna consciousness as a sign of liberation will be explained throughout the 18th chapter, as far as I know. Yeah, I was going to point that out, which is the concluding chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. So he's saying that, okay, there's going to be more detail of this in that chapter. So he's kind of prepping the reader, I think. Seems sensible. Yeah. 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 I'm always wondering this too. Well, yeah, this is... Well, yeah, it seems that materially speaking, in the mode of goodness, you somehow, like... Do you want to throw it in before we... Yep. That kind of bliss. That's why I was pointing out, like, there is some bliss attributed to Brahman realization, which is relationship-less, but in comparison to having interaction, it's not there. So, and in saying that, in the spiritual world, there's all sorts of wonderful things, but actually everything is living. So in that sense, yeah, you can't really. Anyway. Material world, everything's suffering. I mean, everything's suffering and happiness, so... you can essentially, yeah, I mean, that's the point, is like when you become impersonal, you can lose the suffering, but you also lose the enjoyment. You get a neutral state. Thank you. Yeah, this has been my major query these days, of like goodness and good karma and mercy, and like, where is the point? It seems very, like, it doesn't seem very black and white. It seems there's a little bit of some grey. Because... But that's a... I mean, it's like... Well, that's the point here, is it's saying that you can be liberated in this self-same body, which means that your karma doesn't have to essentially be finished with. You're about to get some mercy just now that you're speaking about. So it's like realistically, you should get to the level of Brahmana and you know, try to go beyond that. But it seems that there are those who, I would say, it's from like a previous life thing. You know what I mean? Like someone was at a high level and then they had some karma to burn off that they are a Shudra. You know, we have this concept that the dogs of Vrindavan are sages that had that karma to burn off. So, yeah, it seems like there is some contradiction there that it could be ramificated like that we're burning something off. But ultimately, for me, it's like spirituality is beyond material nature, and mode of goodness often gets lopped into material nature. But it seems like if you are lopped in material nature, goodness is the way to go.
I really like your answer.
Okay, sorry. Oh, yeah. Kshatriya. Yeah, it's tough. But I mean, when Varanashram is about psychophysical nature. I met one boy, Chidananda Gaura, who's probably one of the wisest people in the universe. He just recently got initiated. He was at Bhaktivedanta Swami's Gurukul. And he was like a Shiksha guru for me when he was 14 and I was 22. You know, because he just knows stuff and he's so sincere. And he says, yeah, according to my astrology, he says, I have the body of a Shudra. He says, but the mind of a Brahmin. And you get a lot of this. Like, according to my astrology, I have the mind of a Grihastha, but the life of a sannyasi. You understand? It's like, there's something materially there that is on one level, but then there's another level. It's mixed. Go on. This is discussion now, not so much answer. No, I'm saying from me. Yeah. Kodi Nakshatra. Sense. Well, but what does it mean by Brahmana? Because the word Brahmana is used at different points. Brahmana as an occupation is one thing, but Brahmana's purpose is another thing. Brahmanas is one who gives Brahman, gives spirituality. And that's why Vaishnava is higher, because Brahman can be impersonal. So a Brahmana is someone who gives spirituality, right? So someone who gives Brahman realization is not as great as someone who gives Bhagavan realization, like Raman underway. So therefore he is superior, but his material position is Shudra. So you can have a Brahmin, a ritualistic Brahmin, like Shukracharya, who I have all respect for otherwise, but he is considered the ritualistic Brahmin. You can have people that do the things that Brahmins as a caste do, but don't give knowledge. And this is why at the beginning of the Bhagavatam you have Narada and... Yep. He didn't know because he was a devotee, it says, because of his devotional qualities. Yeah, I mean, you see that. It's like, how is it? I mean, on the material level, he's a kshatriya. You know, he's offering respect to all different brahmanas, but he's probably spiritually more advanced than them, but materially not. So, yeah. But, yeah, it's cool. Anyone else? Something? Granthraj Srimad Bhagavad Gita Ki. Fun today.